Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, welcome to Teach Me to Talk with Laura and Kate. I am Laura Mize, pediatric speech-language pathologist, and today is Thursday, November 20th. It's 6 o'clock Eastern time, so if you're listening now, you're listening live, and we are so excited about tonight's show. I can hardly contain myself. Kate, I know you're there.
Just you're talking much faster than usual. Where's that southern drawl?
Yes, I'm here. I'm cold. We're having the first snowstorm of Louisville.
I know. It's a blizzard. We're excited. Why are we excited, Laura?
Because Dr. Lisa Powell is with us tonight. Yay!
Yay!
Hello.
Thank you so much for being with us, Lisa. Lisa's a pediatric psychologist, and she is a specialist in diagnosing autism, and we are, again, I can hardly contain myself. I'm so glad that you're here to talk with us tonight about autism.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
Well, not as happy as we are. Let's just go ahead and get started. And first of all, Lisa, we want to ask you about the formal process that you use when you get referred in for a family and are there because the team or the parents or the physician has suspected autism. Walk us through that whole process, kind of what you do when you first get a new referral and have a new family.
Okay. Well, it's a pretty long process, and I usually do use formal instruments, but it is just a part of the process. The first thing that I usually do is meet with the family and get a really in-depth interview, background information, you know, trying to gather information about their early development, their history, when they met developmental milestones, walking, talking, you know, even things that are early markers. That's sort of where I can start to see red flags. Parents will talk early on about their child maybe not using eye gaze when feeding, things that we expect even from birth, really.
Right.
Or kids who have mastered certain developmental milestones and then seem to have lost them. So part of it is just getting a really in-depth interview and background information. The other thing I usually do is a lot of observations, and I like to do those in different settings. So, you know, partly in the home and then partly if kids are attending daycare or preschool somewhere, I will go and observe them there, too, to get a sense of their social interaction with peers. And then the other piece of it is, like I said, I do use some formal testing. And not everybody does that. I will say some people will really look at autism as more of a clinical diagnosis that really is, can be achieved just by doing the interview and the observation. But I like to, especially with really young children, use something that's standardized, meaning we have researched it and compared what kids who are typically developing and kids who are on the spectrum do, and we can easily differentiate those two groups by what kids do on these kinds of instruments. So I do formal testing, and when I do that, I look some at their cognitive functioning, which means how they're thinking and reasoning skills, because we know that kids who are on the autism spectrum tend to have lower scores on those kinds of tests than kids even with other developmental disabilities. So that's one way that I'm trying to tease out if it's autism or not. And then I usually look at some adaptive measures, things like, you know, self-help skills and how they're functioning in the community and at home. And then the last piece is that I do usually use a formal instrument that's specifically, a formal test that's specifically for autism. And the one that I use, which I think is sort of the gold standard across the country, is called the ADOS, which is an acronym. It's ADOS, and it stands for the Autism Diagnostic Observation Schedule. And this is a play-based test, and parents are always in the room with me, and kids actually really usually enjoy this test. The idea is that the materials that we use in the test are sort of novel, exciting, really interesting toys, and we want to see not only what the kids do with those toys, but more importantly, how do they try to include the people in the room, which is why we always have a parent versus an examiner or, you know, someone
right.
doing the testing that maybe they don't know. And so we want to see, do they try to include them and show them and share in the excitement of the toys with their parents. So there's, you know, sort of four different areas that we look at in that test, which really coincide with the manual that you all talked about last week, the DSM that we use for diagnosing autism. So we're, of course, looking at language and communication and that social interaction, that reciprocal social interaction, that sort of back and forth flow that you get between people. And then their play also, as well as some stereotype behavior, some of those really restricted kinds of interests that kids will have, like wheels, spinning things, and, you know, some things that we tend to pick up. And the materials that are in that test are really geared to tap some of those things. So typically developing kids won't really care about some of the materials in there. Kids who have some real sensory, really restricted interests, there's some things in there that are really geared to say, to evaluate, is that really going to pique their interest, and is that how they spend the majority of their time during the play assessment. So those are sort of, you know, all of the things that go into it, and it really is a big process. It's sort of like putting the pieces of the puzzle together to try to come up with a picture of what is going on with each child.
What kinds of things, when you're talking to parents about that and when you're doing that observation, what are some things that you would ask parents beyond the milestones and stuff and beyond? Like, if you noticed a child kind of doing atypical play, would you kind of question a parent about that? Talk some about that, about some of the interactions that you have with parents.
Well, lots of things, you know, we're sort of double-checking. I mean, there are other instruments that are based more on parent reports, and a lot of them you all have probably heard of, and lots of parents have asked me about them. One is called the CARS. All these are sort of acronyms. The other one, the MCHAT, is another real popular one, the Modified Checklist for Autism and Toddlers. One of the I do use instruments like that, but I tend to use those more as a screening tool, because those are all asking questions to parents like, does your child point to objects? Do they wave goodbye? Do they, you know, bring you things to show you just for interest? You know, lots of questions like that to see what they typically do, which is really important, because parents know their kids better than anyone. But also what complicates just parent report measures is that, you know, one, lots of times parents are first-time parents and they don't have a good gauge of what's typical. And the other one is that it's not always objective. I mean, as a parent, you can't always objectively look at your own child, especially when you are considering the possibility of something as difficult as autism. You know, I had a family recently where they had been evaluated, I think, 9 or 10 months previously, and there was no diagnosis, and then they came back around because people still had concerns, and so I was doing the evaluation, and the mom said, you know, I think I probably minimized things the first time. I think I just, you know, denied some of the things. I didn't want to endorse them because I just couldn't go there yet. So that's some of the danger in just going on a parent report measure.
So well, you mentioned the MCHAT, you know, when I have to do the MCHAT, you know, for our child evaluation center here, that sometimes when we're sending a child maybe there to get a team assessment, sometimes I can't answer those questions yes and no, because really sometimes the most accurate answer is sometimes, or
that's right.
Occasionally, you know, it is pretty subjective, or a mom might say yes and I might say no.
That's
to the
right.
very same question. Yeah.
Well, and that's really one of the things that is that I do get from it. If I sit down to do a questionnaire like that, I really get more from talking about the question than actually the response to the question.
Right.
Because exactly in the example that you just gave, that's a perfect example, because as you all talked about last week, I mean, that is a red flag when parents say, oh, they can do that, but they really aren't doing it consistently. It's not what we call a functional skill if they're not using it consistently and across settings. So there's lots of things, you know, the one thing that I do think is so important to kind of remember is that how difficult it is to come up with this diagnosis, because I don't take it lightly. It is, you know, such a huge thing to come to and to try to talk to parents about, that you really have to be careful. I really cringe when I think people suggest to parents too cavalierly that, oh, maybe it's autism, which as a parent just sends them, of course, you know, it's so devastating. And so before I ever get to this point, I want to be really careful. And the thing about autism is that, you know, there are no two kids in the world who have autism who look exactly alike. And that's one of the things that makes it so difficult to diagnose, because they exhibit skills sometimes, because they have such unevenness in their development, and sometimes really great strengths in some things, which sort of masks their deficits in other areas.
Right. You were talking about the cognitive piece before, how children with that are on the spectrum typically score lower, but so many parents with children with autism would say, no way, he's smart. He mm-hmm. recognizes numbers. He knows all his letters. He's mm-hmm. reading, without really realizing that that is kind of a splinter skill, and it's
That's right, and it does mask some of the other things. So then it's deceiving because of what you just said. I mean, but the thing about those skills is that they are so narrow. And, you know, I have kids. I have a child who is 2 and can turn on the computer, get on the internet, get to different websites, play different computer games, print things off on the computer, but he doesn't even say mommy yet. So, you know, there's some real unevenness. And when you get those peaks and valleys, that's a real concern. But the difficulty in the diagnosis is that, you know, sometimes people will say, oh, they don't have what we call those classic symptoms that you all have talked about in the past couple weeks. They've got great eye contact. They even can reference some back and forth things. But so the subtleties sometimes that we get with autism are so confusing to parents and honestly to professionals too. You know, going back to that cognitive piece, sometimes kids are so cognitively delayed and maybe even, you know, would be classified as mentally retarded that it really depresses their skill level across the board and it's deceiving. Or some of the kids that you see where their language is so disordered that it makes their social interactions look that disordered.
Right.
So sometimes we get really tricked into thinking, oh, this definitely has to be autism, when it's really not.
And what do you do about a kid that's like that, Lisa? If you went in and if you had a kid that really you thought, gosh, this is, you know, this could go either way here. Let's get language moving along. Or, you know, sometimes it's that you start all of these things and nothing really does move along right away. I mean, what do you do in that situation? Where do you say, we're not going to talk about this yet, or I want to see, you know, I want to stay on here and help you learn some strategies? Tell me what you do, or see them later. What do you recommend in that situation?
Well, I think the most important thing is that we access services and that we get interventions started intensely and immediately, because people, I think, sometimes get caught up in are they autistic, are they not, when really I don't care so much about the formal diagnosis at that point as I do getting the intervention, because lots of times the intervention is the same whether they meet criteria for autism or not. So we have to get started immediately on all of those therapies. You know, the other thing about, you know, these young kids, when we're talking about kids between 2 and 3 years old, we really do have to be careful. I am more apt to sort of hedge and say, let's give this child the benefit of some therapies before we come up with a diagnosis, and then let's reevaluate. And really, some of the new research has shown, while we have gotten much better at catching kids earlier and we are diagnosing much earlier, we have to be careful, because what the new research is showing that is suggesting that, you know, kids under 30 months, the diagnosis is not as stable for those kids, especially for kids who have less severe symptoms.
Right.
So that the research says if we have kids at, you know, under 30 months, let's say 24 months that we're diagnosing, we need to be pretty honest with parents about the lack of stability there, even by 4 years old, you know, especially if they are, you know, under 30 months and it's less severe, the symptoms. Now, those kids at 4, even if they don't meet criteria for autism, usually still have some real problems in terms of development, both language and cognition and things. But those, that new research really should cause us to take more pause and to be more conservative about those early diagnoses.
Wow, I had not heard that. Thank you so much for sharing that with us. But I know that sometimes, you know, I get a kid really early at 20, 22, 24 months, and then they look language-wise remarkably better by the time they're, you know, 33, 36 months. So thanks for sharing that as far as the under 30-month guideline. I'd not heard that before. Kate, had you heard that? Had you read that specifically?
No, I haven't. And I was wondering, I guess that kind of answers, as you were going on about the different tests and whatnot, if there was some kind of steadfast rule about it, you know, you wouldn't even consider diagnosing a child under a certain age, or?
Well, you know, that's a good question. I mean, there are times where I think that most professionals could look at a child and be pretty consistently saying, I think they definitely meet criteria for an autism spectrum diagnosis. Now, those are the kids that we used to refer to as more classic autism, that are just real, more, much more severe symptoms. So certainly that happens, but I would say that, you know, for the protocol and some of the tests that we use, we really shouldn't be administering like the ADOS for kids under 24 months. Mm-hmm. So that would be really the minimum for those, and that test is set up for kids who are pre-verbal, but at the same time, you know, you have to think most of the kids that we're seeing are delayed across the board, so then you even, you know, sometimes even have to back that up further. They may be 24 months, you know, chronologically, but where are they developmentally?
Right.
So, you know, I won't say that we have to have formal tests for every single child, but especially the younger they are and especially when their symptoms seem to be more subtle or you seem to get some of that unevenness. They're not pervasively globally delayed, but they are, you know, have some real strengths in some areas. Those seem to be trickier kids to diagnose and to tease out what exactly is going on with them.
Right. Talk about treatment recommendations. What are some things if you did have a child, you know, between 24 and 30 months that you were seeing for the first time, mm-hmm. and let's say you were initially called in right at the beginning of, you know, a parent kind of going down this road. They haven't started other therapies yet. You know, you're right in there among the first people to assess a child. What kinds of treatment recommendations do you talk about with families?
Well, you know, the American Academy of Pediatrics has recommended about 25 hours of treatment for kids who have been diagnosed with an autism spectrum disorder. Now, there are lots of therapies or approaches that would even say more than that, up to, you know, 40 hours a week, and there are certainly families who do that. I think that the treatment protocol would depend on, obviously, each individual child. So, you know, that 25 hours would be divided up differently for each child depending on where their main, you know, weaknesses are. And that's one of the reasons why I do like to do formal testing, because it gives us something to start with, to say these are the things that are stronger, these are the real deficits. That points to us to say this is where we start to intervene. So that is another reason, even if I don't come up with a formal diagnosis, why I do like to have some of those tests. So, you know, certainly speech therapy, occupational therapy is a part of lots of kids' treatment protocol. Social skills groups or play group or some sort of opportunity to have some exposure to same age, especially typically developing peers. And then in terms of approaches to, you know, treatment, in terms of more of my perspective, you know, there are lots of options. I would say the two most popular options are, one, applied behavioral analysis, which a lot of people call ABA for the acronym of that. And that
talk about what that is, Lisa.
Okay.
Go ahead.
That's probably, I would say, the most studied approach in regard to autism spectrum disorders. It is, you know, based on sort of old theories of operant conditioning. You know, this is very simplistic, obviously, but just the idea for lots of the training is that when we reward certain behaviors, we're going to see those behaviors be repeated over and over. So ABA does teach skills. It's also, I would say, especially known for reducing behavior problems and increasing behaviors that we, you know, more appropriate behaviors or behaviors that we want, pro-social things. So, you know, for instance, they use an approach or they use a technique called discrete trial training. So they would break down a goal of something that we are trying to teach a child into really small steps. And at first, you know, even if they just barely attempted, we would reinforce them with something. And then we would, you know, gradually expect them to do more and more until we expect them to complete the whole behavior before they're reinforced. So that's sort of a simplistic way of describing ABA. You know, clearly, like I said, that's probably the most researched. I would say that the downsides of it is it's pretty time-consuming, that the treatment has to be pretty intensive for it, and that sometimes I think one of the criticisms of it is that we don't always get good generalization, meaning we can teach it in maybe a certain setting or with a certain person, but we don't get good generalization so that the kid doesn't always do it, you know, maybe they'll do it only at home but not at school, or only with a certain person but not with other people. So it's hard to get it to for them to do it consistently. So that's a very quick, obviously, overview of ABA. And the other main approach I would say is floor time, which you all talked a little bit about in one of your weeks past, which, as you said, is an approach that was developed by Stanley Greenspan, who is a developmental psychiatrist in Washington, D.C. And it's a very different approach and a newer approach, a newer way to think about what are the goals for kids with autism and really other kids with delays as well. And basically his approach is saying we need to attend to the child's emotional development, and the idea is that we all learn best when we're really emotionally engaged with people. And so that's the main goal, is to help kids be engaged. It's an intensive also therapy, one-to-one intervention, where you're really trying to either parent-child or therapist-child create as many opportunities for that child to stay attending with you, to encourage relatedness between you and the child, and to get communication in that back-and-forth flow. And it's a, you know, and again, it's a play-based approach. It's usually based on, you know, a real fun, high-energy, high-affect, meeting the child with what they're interested in, even if it doesn't seem particularly, you know, productive, but we meet them there and try to expand on it and try to engage them emotionally around that activity.
Right.
I have a clear bias to that approach. I like to use it, and I've seen it have some really good effects with kids. I think that as a parent, the thing that parents want most is to feel connected with their child, and I think that's
right.
One of the hardest things about autism is that parents don't get a lot of that back from their kids typically, and so we really have to teach kids how to do that, how to connect with us socially. And Greenspan refers to that, look, it's a real subtle, you know, that qualitative difference that you all talked about, but he refers to that as the gleam in their eye. And parents
right.
know what that feels like when their child looks at them, even if they don't have a word that they've just learned to say, but they're connected with them emotionally. And that's a really powerful thing for parents.
Sometimes I really have to teach parents how to look for that, though, because they really...
Absolutely.
Once you point it out and once you say, look, there it is,
mm-hmm.
see, he's twinkly, he's,
mm-hmm.
he lit up, that's it, that's what we're going for. Sometimes parents really don't recognize it as that, even if
mm-hmm.
it's just, and you know, sometimes it's an all-over thing and it might last for a while, and sometimes it's very fleeting, and you do have to say, for 1 second we kind of got in there, or for a shorter amount of time, and then he kind of, you know, this happened, and he's gone again. But I think I spend some time trying to teach parents how to look for that, not only how to get it, but how to recognize it once they've gotten it. And you're right, once they realize, oh, that's what she means, there is a qualitative difference there when you get a child to that point versus what they might have considered engaged before.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make sense to you?
Yeah, I do think it's hard. I think in general, that's one of the hardest problems, is that we don't see huge leaps and bounds very quickly. The progress is slower, and it's much harder for parents because, of course, we all want to know that when we're pouring in 30 hours a week of therapy that we're getting something, and sometimes the progress is just so much slower than parents want.
Right. And, you know, I think floor time, too, when parents hear that 25 hours a week, first they get kind of scared and thinking, oh, how am I going to afford all this therapy? And then we say, oh, no, you're doing the main part of this here at home, and we're going to teach you how. And then the next thing is, how am I ever going to find 25 hours in a week to do this? I have a full-time job. I have two other kids. So
That's
talk
right.
a little bit about that and how Dr. Greenspan recommends that be broken up, and how you see that work with families, and how you teach families to do that. Talk some about that time thing.
Well, I mean, that's one of the things I do like about the model. I think it's empowering for parents to know that they can be in charge of their child's treatment, as opposed to always relying on some outside person to come in and you know, engage with their child. They can do this once we teach them, and it's more powerful with the, you know, fostering that connection than it is even fostering the connection between the child and the therapist. So it
Right.
is important, but it is hard work for parents, and I think that. One of the things that we always try to do is to think about, okay, who else can be involved here? I mean, I always, you know, try to elicit engagement from grandparents, babysitters, neighbors, aunts, uncles. You know, older siblings are great at floor time, and we don't
yeah.
even have to train them so well. But there are lots of people. I mean, it really is a time for a family to tap all of their resources, because it is very time and labor intensive, and you really need as many people as you can to be able to do it. So I think just from that standpoint, the other thing is that I really try to teach families, Greenspan does prescribe it as sort of a 20, 30-minute block of time, but it doesn't have to be where you're doing nothing else except for sitting on the floor and playing with them. I mean, that should certainly be a part of it, but you can also do it in the grocery store, in the bathtub, while you're cooking dinner. I mean, you really can integrate it into other parts of your day, and I think that's the reality of how parents have to do it. Especially
right.
parents who are working and have other children, and you have to get kind of creative sometimes about how to, you know, exactly what it looks like in your family.
Right, but don't you think the parents who kind of master that and who really take that commitment on, just and really learn, okay, I am gonna learn how to do this, even if it's so uncomfortable in the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
I see such great results with those families whose parents have really made themselves learn how to incorporate floor time like that.
Exactly. And then I do think that parents get that reinforcement, which keeps them going. You know, once you get that smile where they're smiling at you, socially directed for the first time and looking at you, and you feel so connected, that's enough to kind of keep us as parents going a little bit longer. And so
right.
you do get you know, that kind of intimacy from a child that you don't maybe get in other kinds of therapies. And I think that goes a long way into helping parents to keep going when it's really hard work.
Right. And how do you recommend that parents learn floor time?
Well, that's a hard thing because, unfortunately, we don't have great, you know, we don't live in Washington, D.C., but
right.
there are always lots of training options there. There's also the Floor Time DVD series, which I think is a great resource for families. And the other thing that I do is try to get families to, you know, connect with each other. You know, families are each other's best resources, so families are sharing videotapes, are sharing the DVD series, are sharing even videotapes that we make, because lots of times I'll do videotaping with families
right.
for lots of reasons, for the assessment part, but also for the teaching part, because that's really important for maybe the parent who's at work and wasn't there
right.
that to see it. And maybe it's important, too, to share with friends. And I've had lots of people, you know, who've been comfortable to share that. And that's a good resource, too, you know, to kind of network with each other to share those things.
But you do mostly teaching floor time one-on-one with parents. Wouldn't you say that you do that mostly?
I do. So that's,
yeah.
I would say, where I start. And so I will, you know, explain sort of the theory behind it, watch some of the videos. I would start with modeling that for them, and then I will have them do it, and I coach them. Because it's a hard thing. It comes more naturally to some people to sit down and play and be kind of silly all the time and really animated, and it really takes a lot of energy. It's kind of exhausting. But but when they get stuck, I do lots of coaching, like, how about you do this, and can you go on a, you know, picnic at the park, and can you, and sort of like the little bug in their ear to try to keep it going and see how long we can sustain it, and then we'll switch off back and forth. And lots of times I'll have families sort of keep a log kind of too about what things are working, what's the hardest thing. They're, you know, for some parents, the child's running in the other room and that's already even containing them. For other people, it's hard to come up with ideas about what to play about because these kids have, you know, tend to get stuck sometimes. So lots of homework for parents about practicing in between and then coming back and sort of troubleshooting afterwards what's working and what's not.
Right. We mentioned last week floortime.org has kind
mm-hmm.
of a basic overview on the site. What other resources do you give parents to read and to look at besides the Floor Time DVD series?
Yeah, well, you all mentioned lots of good ones last time, the Engaging Autism, of course. If you are on floortime.org, there is a link to the ICDL, which is another acronym. I think it's the Interdisciplinary Council, help me, you guys probably know, of Developmental and Learning Disorders, something to that.
I think that's it, yeah.
Is that close? And there's lots of resources on that website as well about how to get started even with floor time and specific floor time activities to do. So that's another good website. I think, you know, the other Greenspan books that you talked about are typically the ones. There's also there are a couple of other people who have developed some sort of similar approaches to the floor time approaches that also have some information through books and through DVD series. There is a approach called the relationship-based intervention, RBI. Rebecca Klaw is the one who, it's K-L-A-W, who has developed that. Have you all ever seen her work?
I haven't, no.
Okay.
I haven't either.
You haven't? I have the DVD. And she, the DVD is a good teaching tool for parents, but it also has lots of resources on there that you can print off in PDF form and use for, you know, for activities and things. So that's another one that's sort of similar that you might want to.
Give us that web address again. Lisa, you said Klaw, K-L-A-W.
Her name is Rebecca, R-E-B-E-C-C-A, and then the last name Klaw, K-L-A-W. And it's RBI, Relationship-Based Intervention.
Okay. I'm going to look that one up.
Yeah, it's just RebeccaKlaw.com.
Okay.
So it's a pretty new series and DVDs and work things that she's got out there that are really useful. And I think they're pretty family friendly. The only hard thing I think sometimes, I'm sure you all found this too, about floor time stuff, sometimes people get stuck in the theoretical part and it's hard to apply.
Yeah.
And so sometimes I think people respond to Rebecca Klaw's work. It doesn't seem to be as heavy sometimes in the theory part, which kind of bogs people down, I think.
Now, is she a psychologist, Lisa?
She is.
Okay.
And I don't know. She might be a developmental psychologist. I'm not sure exactly what her training is.
Okay.
Yeah.
Oh, well, good. Thanks for sharing that resource. Any more that you can think of that Kate and I may have not ever?
Not specifically about floor time, but I would say that my first recommendation, especially, in terms of just giving a diagnosis to families, I don't know if you all have ever used the Autism Source Book. Do you all ever use that?
I have used that, yeah.
The bright orange book.
Mm-hmm.
It has just so many things in there. I think especially in the beginning when you're sort of, overwhelmed and don't know which way to go, I think it's a good resource. It really talks about, diagnosis and treatment options, but things that are really hard to learn, which are like how to advocate in the school system, how to deal with insurance companies, how to deal with even just the coping and all that. It really has, I think, some good resources for parents. So that's always one that I think people should start with. It's a good thing to just go back and refer to, too, as you get to a different point where you have a new, issue that you're trying to resolve, be it school and, IEPs and things like that. There's just lots of good resources. How the diagnosis impacts siblings, how it affects the marital relationship. I mean, there's lots of good things in there. So I think that would be one of my recommendations for resources.
Now, who's the author of that book, or what company is that book?
It's the Autism Source Book, Diagnosing, Treatment, Coping, and Healing. And the author is Karen Siff. S-I-F-F, and then the last name, E-X-K-O-R-N.
Okay, and I have seen that before. I had that earlier in my career. I don't know what's happened to that book. It's how old is that?
Let's see. I think 2005.
Okay.
What was the last name?
Something else.
It's Karen Siff, S-I-F-F, and then E-X-K-O-R-N, X-Corn.
Okay. Okay, good. Well, thank you for telling us about that one, too.
Mm-hmm.
Let's move on and talk about something that we had a conversation about earlier today. What in the world do you do when a parent starts trying to talk to you about other things that they might hear in the media from other parents, the whole biomedical piece? I know we don't want to talk about that a lot because that's certainly not mine and Kate's area of knowledge at all, but I know parents probably bring that up to you, so talk
Absolutely.
About that a little bit.
And I wouldn't say that it's my area of expertise either, but I do think it's important to, be aware of, and I try to, at least keep on top of what some of the newer and more alternative treatments are. I think that the problem becomes when there are so many treatment options. It's so overwhelming for parents, and I think sometimes people make decisions about what treatment options to take, which are more based in emotional you know, needs and wants rather than scientific evidence. So I would say start with things that we know are more scientifically based, that are more research-based, the things that we already talked about before, speech and OT and floor time and ABA and those approaches, social skills and all of those things. Now, you know, certainly there's lots of alternatives. And, you know, the other thing is I would say start there, and then if you want to add other things, that's okay. But the problem is that when we do too many things at one time, we don't know what works. So that when we see some change, we don't know what to attribute the change to. Was it one of the 25 therapies that we were doing? So I would say if you want to add something, then that's okay, but one at a time so that we can really assess the effectiveness of it. You know, I mean, I say all the time to talk to parents about how, you know, every child with autism is different and the presentation of symptoms is so different for every child. So I also need to be open to the fact that maybe the treatment is different for every child. And so most of what we have for, you know, other treatment options like the gluten-free, casein-free diet or vitamin supplements or cranial sacral or any of those things, what we have to support those is more anecdotal evidence, meaning stories that parents have told. And so, you know, it's hard to discount that a parent has said that this has really worked for my child. So I don't want to discourage someone from doing those, but I do think there's sort of a first line of intervention. And then if you want to try some other things, then, you know, that's certainly there, you know, it's certainly an option. And the other thing is I think that we all have to be open to that treatment plans may change over time, and kids might need different things, and that as they reach different developmental periods, we really do have to stop and reevaluate our treatment and what are we doing and what's working and what's not working. And when families are evaluating treatment, you know, different kinds of therapies, I think they should also be working with their providers, their therapists, to say, how are we evaluating whether we're making progress here? Because they should have some way to be able to do that. So that they can keep evaluating, do we need to add something else? Do we need to do less of this and more of this? But my concern is that there's not really good evidence research to support some of the more alternative methods.
Right. But what do you say to parents? And I've had this come up where I got an email back of the summer where a parent said she had a little girl who I think she was more like 5, and she was nonverbal. And she said she had gotten the diagnosis when she turned 3 and that she decided, based on things she had read, is that she would try to heal her body first and not do any other more traditional therapy in speech, OT, DI. I'm sure Kate's been wanting to throw that in.
Nope, I'm taking the 5th tonight.
Throw it out there, Kate. Come on.
I was waiting for Dr. Powell to mention it, but I didn't hear that one come out. That's okay.
I'll give DI the big shout out.
I'm used to it.
But what do you say to parents like that? I mean, of course, and I'm totally biased because speech is what I do and language is what I think about all day, every day, 24/7, and can't imagine that you would not work on language when that's probably the base of the problem. But, you know, what would you say to a parent who said, I really want to try to heal his body and then I'm going to worry about all that other stuff later?
Well, I mean, I think educating, you know, parents have to educate themselves, and they and you know, to be able to read and evaluate and think about what they're reading about. I mean, there just isn't good evidence to support those, so they have to critically evaluate when they're reading something whether there's good evidence to support. Where is it that says that this is, you know, been something that has worked? The other thing is I always shy away from things. I mean, you can look back in the history of the past 10, 15 years, and every, you know, year you can see sort of what was the new treatment of the year. And those things tend to come and go pretty quickly. But the things that have really been more established that are the same things that we're talking about, you know, year after year, that we have had research that we really, that are based in what we know about child development and, you know, emotional development and learning behaviors and all of those things, they have a much better foundation and a more researched background than some of these things that just happen to be new, you know, therapies of the year kind of thing.
Right, but you would tell a parent straight out, I mean, I know you would because I work with you and serve on teams with you. You would say, please, please reconsider and do some speech and some OT and some social kinds of things even while you're exploring that?
I would say DI. You have to do DI. No, I would. I would.
Yay for Dr. Powell!
I would. I would absolutely
sure would.
Say all of those
mm-hmm.
things first.
Well, it brings to mind that, which, you know, has been in the news with Jenny McCarthy,
mm-hmm.
and she really kind of gave a lot of support to the whole biomedical approach and acted like that was, what made the difference. And then
mm-hmm.
when you kind of read the details, well, he got speech and he got OT.
He got a lot of speech.
He got a whole,
that's right. So that goes to the point. You don't really know what it was. And you know, I am biased as you all, and I would tend to think that it was because of all of those speech and all of the therapy, all of the things that we know work, and then maybe the other things, maybe that you know, tipped it a little bit more. I don't know. But I worry about those kinds of approaches because there's a good example of anecdotal evidence. I mean, when she was on, I don't know if you all saw on Larry King, you know, there are scientists are saying these are all the research studies that we've had, and this is all it's. And hers was a stack of emails from parents, and I'm not discounting that because parents know their kids best, but it's not the same thing because
Right. Each
of those individual parents figured out what worked for their child. But that's
Right. Very
different than saying this is a treatment that we should apply to all children.
Right.
Yeah, and I don't think she's been as vocal about all of the background, the other things that they've done, too. They had a huge time commitment with speech. I mean, he had multiple sessions a week.
Right.
From what I've read. And I haven't read any of her stuff lately, and I hope I don't get angry emails or calls about this and us saying we're giving Jenny a hard time. But, you know, when
really... she's been a great champion as far as getting the word out there about autism, and, you know, that's a good thing. But she does kind of... if you're not careful to read the details, it sounds like, oh, I fixed the body and everything else came along without any help, but really there was a lot of other help there.
Right. And the other thing that we were talking about, Lisa, that I thought was such a great point is that when you have a child that's diagnosed with autism, you are so desperate to want to try anything, and you're kind of emotionally at a point where you would do anything, spend anything, go anywhere, where kind of rational thought may leave you, because as parents, we all want to do everything we can to make sure that our children get the help that they need. But that, I think that's a time when you might not make the most logical decision for your family, too.
Right. And that's what worries me. I'm sad when I hear parents going, I mean, they're expending so many resources and so much money and time to things that, you know, are pretty experimental. And so when you have to choose, or when you're spending all of those resources on something that is really sort of a shot in the dark, but then of course that takes away from some of the things that we know do work. And that's really where my concern is, if it's at the expense of things that really work.
Right. Right.
Have you all, Laura or Lisa, ever seen a child, I'm just posing this question randomly, have you ever worked with a child in your many years of therapy, a child that really did seem to respond to that biomedical piece, whether it was to putting on the gluten-free diet, or that you just said, oh my gosh, this has been remarkable, where you really had to? I personally have not.
You know, I haven't, but that's only because I probably wouldn't be, the only kids that I'm involved with are doing all of the things that we talked about, the things that we know
Right. Work.
So.
Right.
I don't think I've had anybody that I've ever known who's only done those things.
But sometimes that piece gets added later on for whatever
Right. Reason,
and I can't say I've certainly seen kids make remarkable progress, but never did it seem to be directly connected to, wow, they've taken out all the gluten and casein in their diets, and this child has, you know, changed into a different child. I
mm-hmm.
personally have never seen. I've had a few cases where I thought maybe it is
mm-hmm.
helping, but
Right. Never
any case where I thought, wow, you know, that was unbelievable.
Me too. And I feel the same way about that. And then I just think about, as a mom, that diet would be so hard to do.
Yeah.
And, you know, especially when you have other children, you know, when one or both parents work, when you're busy with, you know, just life, I don't know that I could be committed enough to do that if I didn't think I was going to get pretty amazing results.
Well,
and
so many
where
kids
it is hard
have eating aversions that it would be hard to, you know, you might have to take away two of the five things that he will eat, you know.
Right. Or four of the five things.
Yeah.
I will say that I'm more apt to maybe suggest that as a possibility after we, of course, have gotten all the other things in line for those kids who seem to have real gastrointestinal problems, and lots
right.
of these kids do.
Mm-hmm.
So that seems to make sense, and the theory behind this GFCF diet seems to make sense for kids like that.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, that may be a time where I would say, what about we add this? Let's just try it. But it is expensive as well. It's
mm-hmm.
it's difficult, it's labor intensive, and it's expensive to change that and buy all the things that you need to do that are gluten, casein free. So,
right. And I have had kids, lots of kids who've been on that diet. But again, we don't know whether it's been 9 months of everybody doing their best and, you know, all the speech, all the OT, all the DI, all the play group, all the floor time at home. You know, we really don't know what's been the factor there and why they've made progress. I mean, I don't want to say that I've never had kids that we don't think that that's helped, because that would not be true. But, you know, and again, we're not exposed usually to families who are just trying that piece. You know, we don't work with those families if that's all that they're doing, since we all do the other stuff.
Right. Dr. Powell, I'll pick your brain again. We wanted to ask, when you diagnose a child, do you make an effort, or always, or let me just say, what do you do about, you say they're on the spectrum, do you
mm-hmm.
break that down any further generally, or...
No, the only time, I mean, and really, you know, I know you all were talking about the DSM, and that really is obviously what we always go to say whether we meet criteria, but at the same time, that the way the DSM is written is really not in line. It's really outdated in terms of how we think about autism, because we don't think of it as we used to, of just one, you know, sort of disorder. We do think
right.
of it as a spectrum. So the way that the criteria are written doesn't match, it doesn't reflect that spectrum. So that being said, I mean, I think that the only time that I would maybe make a differential besides just an autism spectrum is to say, you know, PDD, NOS, which you all talked about sometimes, and those are the kids that really there is something, you know, they may meet some of the criteria but not all, and so, you know, sometimes it makes sense to use that as a diagnosis. That there is some pervasive developmental, but it's not a classic autism spectrum. It's something about that doesn't reflect how their child is presenting.
Right. And if you were going to coach Kate and me, if we had gone back 3 weeks ago, would you have told us, okay, don't use the whole DSM-4 as kind of a way to start to talk about it? What could we have used that would have been different?
No, I think you still have to, because, it, like I said, it is the only thing that we have, and that is how we, you know, come up with all kinds of disorders. They have to, you know, meet those criteria. So it is still... the, you know, what we use, but I would say that it's we apply it a little more loosely than we used to, because it
right.
doesn't reflect that spectrum. And we know
right.
now that kids, you know, we include kids on that spectrum that maybe wouldn't meet criteria from that formal diagnosis. We know, or, you know, from those DSM criteria.
Right.
We
and
know
more
now. And
how do you explain that to parents? What do you say about that if you have a kid like that? And I know we talked about that a little bit earlier.
Yeah.
But yeah.
Well,
what
I do. I think that a lot of times, you know, when I go through the ADOS, that really helps them to understand what I'm looking at and what some of the, you know, what makes me say that, come up with that as a diagnosis. But, you know, so I do go through those same categories, like I said, go through the language and communication, and then look at, you know, some of the things that you all talked about, pointing and gesturing and spontaneous language, and is their language socially directed? That's so different. And I'm sure you do this all day long, Laura, try to help people understand the difference between just some labeling and of things, you know, as opposed to socially directed language. You know, then we always look at the reciprocal social interaction. So are they requesting? Are they giving? Are they showing? Are they responsive in their social smile? We smile at them or do something real silly and they smile back. All that joint attention that you all have talked about, are there, you know, at a higher level too, can they integrate that? It's very different when kids who, you know, maybe have some interaction, they'll come up and sort of, you know, give you something or hold something out, like, help me do this or whatever. That's a very different level of social interaction than when they look you in the eye and hand you it at the same time. That's a more integrated, higher level of functioning that we're looking for. So trying to help parents understand what are we looking at, because like I said, sometimes it's so subtle, and sometimes parents, I'm sure they say this to you all the time too, but they can do this and they can do this. And so to help them understand, you don't have to, and no child is going to have all of those symptoms, but you will have, you know, kids who have different ones, and it still constitutes autism, but it looks different in every child. And that's what I think is so hard to understand for us and for parents.
Right, and so what do you say with a parent who's having a really hard time with that diagnosis? I know you get them because, you know, we get them, and we're all, you know, kind of serving the same population here. But what do you say? Do you
that's
think
when
most people
say, let's
time,
get Dr. Powell in here?
Yeah, I know what that's what Kate and I say. We want to get Dr. Powell in to talk to you about all this.
Well,
you know what? We've tried, but we need the expert.
Well, it is hard, though. I mean, I do try to back up sometimes and, you know, think about where the parents are. You know, I know you want to talk some about coping and how to even help families.
Right.
And I think that's a big part of it. You know, parents, I think, go through a grief process when we have to tell them that this is where we think their child is. Even parents who knew it at some level, it is devastating when we actually say those words to them.
Right.
And so I think that parents really do go through that process. You know, the famous, well-known psychiatrist, Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, who has those stages of grief developed, I think that parents really do go for those through denial and anger and bargaining and depression and acceptance and a ton of guilt. I'm sure you all hear this, but that's especially moms, I think, have so much guilt when they get this diagnosis. Not that it's founded, but it's emotional. They feel, you know, was it their genes? Was it something they ate during pregnancy? Was it they were too old? The labor wasn't right. They shouldn't have immunized their kids. They should have interacted more. You know, something that they did or didn't do. So I think that we have to, you know, let parents have some time to go through those. The hard part is that while we have to respect their stage of acceptance of the diagnosis, we also have to push them to educate themselves and, most importantly, to get the treatment set up. And that's really hard to do all at the same time. So I really try to help parents to sort of compartmentalize that, which is you should grieve and you have to, you know, work this through and, you know, go through those stages of grief. But you have to, you know, set aside a time to do that, because in the meantime, the clock is ticking and we have to get educated about what the treatment options are and get your treatment set up, because we know the earlier the better. It makes a big difference in terms of the prognosis. So it's really hard to respect parents', you know, grief process, and at the same time push them really hard to get educated and to get set up with the treatment. It's a problem to do. It's hard. It's really hard to do both. And the other thing I really push parents to do is to get connected with other parents. Because not only because of sharing resources and how other parents have the best understanding of, you know, what doctors are the most receptive and what insurance and what schools and what psychologists and what, you know, service providers, but also they are really the only other people in the world who understand what these parents are going through. They are the only ones who have children with autism who live this every single day. So it's really important to get them hooked up. I know you all mentioned autismspeaks.org last time, and they have a great social network on there that parents can go to. I don't know if you guys have ever used that or had parents who have accessed that before. But it's an all online social network. I mean, all cities have support groups, which I really encourage, but that's hard too, because child care and all kinds of things. So this is a nice alternative for parents who, you know, can do it from their house, who can still be connected with other parents.
And Lisa, I wanted to interject quickly before we run out of time, as we always do. What are some of the advantages to getting a diagnosis? In addition to, yes, you need to get on board and get the therapist and get yourself educated and all that, are there other things beyond that, kind of real-world things that play into?
There are. I mean, I'm always mindful of that when I'm doing an evaluation for the early intervention program, because our time is so limited. So we're sort of trying to jockey, you know, like I said, being cautious and mindful of what the research is showing us about age and, you know, diagnostic stability. But also we need for this child to be able to go into the school system and access services. So that is one you know, most important thing is that we need them to be able to get on an IEP, to be able to get all of their services through their school, whatever those might be. So they do need a diagnosis to do that. The other thing is for insurance. I mean, that's the other reality, that in order to access lots of services, we need that diagnosis. Now, some services can be tapped by, you know, a language diagnosis or, you know, some other developmental diagnoses, but autism in particular, when we're trying to access that level of services, we do need that diagnosis. So,
yeah, and I think you're going to have an easier time if you have a diagnosis like autism versus something like language delay.
That's
or something.
Right.
So many policies do not cover developmental delays, and so to have a formal diagnosis really kind of gets you over that hurdle, and then you don't have to fight about who's going to pay for all this.
Right, right. So I would say educational and health are our main, are the main, you know, reasons that we also do need a diagnosis if there was, if there is one that's appropriate for the child.
Right. Also seems like sometimes when there is a diagnosis, kind of brings parents around sometimes about taking it seriously and really committing to the whole process. You know, it becomes very real, difficult, but real, and it can help kind of get them moving on dealing with it.
Mm-hmm. I think it does, because, and especially when we start talking about the 25 hours a week, because that really gets parents' attention.
Mm-hmm.
And the whole just kind of putting a number on it and thinking, okay, I've got to take this seriously. And again, you know, we've all said it. We said it last week, and then you said it again tonight. The research really tells us that the earlier children get treated, the more intensely they're treated, the better chance that they are going to have a more positive outcome. Are you guys still there?
We're here.
Pause. So what would you say kind of closing?
And how? I totally agree. How about you, Lisa?
This ends in a giggle fest every single
now,
week.
Now, really, you know, it is true, and I always say to parents, whether there's a formal diagnosis or not, he or she is who he or she is, and,
right.
You know, it really doesn't change so much. I think it's a difficult pill to swallow, and I certainly understand that, but, you know, I know even the short time that we're able to see kids, and for me, frequently, that's between 2 and 3, maybe 18 months and 3, and Laura, you're generally about the same. Sometimes we see such incredible progress that we would never even venture to hope or pray that they'd get there, even in a year or 6 months.
Right.
Or so it can, you know, the progress at this early age can be so incredible that there's every reason to commit to it as early as possible.
And Lisa, you see older children than probably Kate and I see, because I do keep, you know, see some of my little friends that I've had through our early intervention program, you know, on through 3 and 4. And by the time they're 5, they are mostly sick of me, and I am begging their parents to move on to a more grown-up speech therapist, since I'm the baby speech pathologist. But, I mean, what do you think about those older kids, you know, somebody who gets a diagnosis later versus earlier? I mean, their outcomes, I know it's so individualistic with every child, but don't you think on the whole?
On the whole, yeah, the research suggests that kids who, right, the earlier we diagnose them, obviously depending on the severity of their symptoms, but it does, they do tend to do better. I do think that's one of the hardest things for parents, though. Of course, as soon as we give a diagnosis, you know, the first thing that they want to know is, well, what is this going to mean, and what are they going to look like in 3, 4, 5 years? And that is the hardest thing, because we can't really predict exactly what they're going to look like. We just don't know. I mean, we know some things, you know, age of diagnosis matters, the symptom severity matters, and the cognitive skills matter. Those are, I would say, important indicators for long-term prognosis. But we don't yet understand why some kids are responding much better to treatment than others. There is actually a research study going on right now at University of Connecticut to look at exactly that. Why is it that some kids are coming to a point where they don't even meet criteria for autism anymore? And that's actually a pretty controversial thing. There are some people who say, no, once you have the diagnosis, you always have the diagnosis, or it was misdiagnosed if you don't. But there are other people who are more of the mindset that, no, it's a current diagnosis, and there are kids who will no longer carry that diagnosis, or at least meet the criteria. Now, most of those kids, like I said, still may have some subtle things, you know, emotional behavior, usually ADHD or something, or some language sequelae still from it. But most of those kids, there's still something lingering. But there are kids who no longer meet criteria. So we are trying to figure out more and more what is it, why some kids, and what are the predictors that would help us understand which kids are going to be the ones who do better long term.
Right.
Do you have a gut feeling on if you see a child initially, and I guess I shouldn't ask you being recorded, but do you have a gut feeling on, gee, I'm going to go with this child has a pretty good prognosis, or is there one, whether it be a social piece or a cognitive piece or a communication piece, or is it, you know, is one of those?
No, it's usually because they are higher functioning cognitively and because they have less severe symptoms, and usually because the kids who I'm most encouraged about are the ones who have the skills, but they don't use them consistently. So they have, you know, sort of those islands that we refer to of joint attention. They can do it sometimes. Sometimes you feel like they're really connected to you and they have it, but 2 seconds later it's done and they're sort of off in their own world again. Those are the kids, though, that, you know, I'm sure, Laura, it's the same for language. You see kids who,
right,
you know, while they have some of that stereotypical language, that's still language. And so we can...
Right. They're talking. Yeah.
That's right. That's right. So the same thing for those that kids who do have some of that reciprocal social interaction sometimes and have joint attention sometimes. Those are the kids I usually think, okay, this is a lot to work with. We're not starting from the very beginning where we're just working on engagement or we're just working on real basic attention and engagement. You know, those are kids who are much further along who we think, okay, we need them to not do this in islands. We need them to do this consistently throughout the day.
Right, but those are the parents, at least on my caseload and throughout my career, who really might kind of balk at a diagnosis.
Mm-hmm.
And I tell them, okay, I don't care what we call it. It doesn't matter to me. We're just going to do the treatment. We're just going to do what we know works with this kind
right.
of kid.
And I don't care either whether people are ready to accept the diagnosis, as long as they understand that what we're saying is this child has some real, real deficits that we have to address, and we have to address them intensively right now.
Right.
As long as they get that piece of the message, then, you know, the formal diagnosis piece can go or come. We can, you know, work through that piece from an emotional standpoint later. That takes time. As long as they can get the treatment piece now.
Right. Well, we all three agree on that point, and we are at the end of our hour. Thank you so much, Lisa, for being with us tonight.
Oh, you're welcome. It was fun.
Yeah, thanks for doing it.
Okay, talk
Bye.
To you girls later.
Bye.
Bye.
Bye.